everybody, from your North Carolina Reading Service, John Federson reading for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And what am I reading? The Independent, the Indie Week, weekly publication. And this edition is dated November the 7th of 2024. And our election, recently finished but not certified yet, has quite a few local articles that the Independent has included in this issue. And I'll read all of those that we have on that issue, both in print and at IndieWeek.com, which is their online presence. And those articles are updated. If you need more information about some of them, you can go to IndieWeek, that's one word, IndyWeek, IndieWeek.com. We'll begin in Raleigh and Wake County. Some of these may be scattered a little bit, these articles, in terms of location, but they'll try to keep them consistent. Janet Cowell has won the mayorship of Raleigh, a five-way race. Cowell, 56, won this contest to succeed two-term Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin, who didn't seek re-election, and Cowell received a preliminary 61% of the vote. A former Raleigh City Councilor, State Senator, and State Treasurer, Cowell most recently served as the President and CEO of the Dix Park Conservancy. She stepped down from her position there on October the 4th to focus full-time on her campaign. With the early vote, plus a few precincts reporting, Cowell defeated four other candidates in the race: Terrence Ruth, community activist, NC State professor, who had run against Baldwin in 2022 and won 41% of the vote. Well, she received 10.9% in this race. Paul Fitz, a conservative mortgage lender, received 18.5%. Eugene Myrick, an educator and community advocate, received 6.3% of the vote. And James Shaughnessy IV, a William Peace University student, received 3% of that vote. Next, from IndieWeek, all five incumbents on the Wake County Board of Education will hold on to their seats. Wing Ning appears poised to serve a second term in District 3 seat following a tight race against the newcomer Jordine Blaze. Ning is a 56-year-old physician and registered Republican, one of two on the majority Democratic school board, and he has represented District 3, which stretches from northern Raleigh up through Wake Forest to the top of Wake County, since 2022. In that time, he's advocated for special education reform, promoted this parents' rights movement, expressed support for an expensive private school voucher program, criticized federal Title IX protections for LGBTQ students in public schools, and tried to block a diverse books grant. He campaigned for re-election alongside far-right candidates for governor and state superintendent of public instruction, Mark Robinson and Michelle Morrow. Blaze, a leadership consultant and former teacher, ran on a platform of improving educational equity and raising staff pay. She lost to Nguyen by a razor-thin margin of just about 1 point. Toshiba Rice will keep her District 4 seat on the board. She defeated challengers Sean Collin and Michael T. Williams. Rice, 50, was appointed to the board Friday after her predecessor, Tara Waters, left to join the Wake County Board of Commissioners. Rice is CEO of a wellness consulting firm in Raleigh and executive director of Track My Steps, a statewide education nonprofit dedicated to closing economic and racial achievement gaps. During her first few months on the school board, she voted alongside her fellow Democrats to bring the school system into compliance with federal Title IX updates, which expand the protections for LGBTQ students. She also voted against renewing the school system's contract with its resource officers, citing their unequal treatment of black and brown students. She was endorsed by the Wake County Democratic Party and the NC Association of Educators. The District 4 race began as a four-way contest between Rice, Callan, Williams, and Roberto Morales Vergara, a fiscal analyst for the city of Raleigh, who had the endorsement of the Wake County Republican Party. In August, Morales Vergara dropped out of the race, citing, quote, deep disappointment with the leadership of Wake GOP, and endorsed Rice. His name still appeared on the ballot, however. We'll skip now to a larger forum, the North Carolina Congressional District in the U.S. House. Democratic Representative Deborah Ross won re-election with 66% of the vote over Republican challenger Alan Swain. She was first elected to Congress in 2020 and will continue representing much of Wake County, including most of Raleigh, parts of Cary, Morrisville, and Garner. She's 60 years old, a former state legislator and civil rights attorney, and has focused on strengthening voting rights, expanding health care access, and supporting Triangle Area tech and research initiatives during her time in Congress. 11 bills she introduced during her first term were signed into law, including legislation that increased funding for sexual assault nurse examiners and boosted North Carolina's offshore wind energy potential. Recently, she helped secure $800,000 in federal grant funding for public transit improvements in eastern Wake County. That was the 2nd Congressional District. U.S. House District 4, Valerie Fouché, as expected, has locked down a second term, representing the deep blue 4th Congressional, which includes Durham, Orange, Alamance, Granville, and Person counties. She first won this seat in 22 after a contentious Democratic primary against Durham County Commissioner Nida Alam. That race was one of the most expensive congressional primaries in state history, with Fouché receiving significant support from the pro-Israel PAC, AIPAC. A former school board member, county commissioner, and state legislator, Fouché has prioritized education funding, environmental protection, and modernizing the Triangle's transit infrastructure during her first term in Congress. She serves on the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, where she recently helped secure a $12 million federal grant to overhaul 33 Durham intersections with improved crosswalks, ADA-compliant curb ramps, and upgraded bus stops. In the spring, she quietly traveled to Israel on APAC's dime and sat almost directly across the table from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as he requested help in, quote, ensuring that Gaza doesn't pose a threat to Israel again. And finally, in this report, House District 13, Brad Knott, Republican, has captured the open seat in District 13, defeating Democrat Frank Pierce with nearly 60% of the vote. His win is not particularly surprising, given the district was so aggressively redrawn last year that it sent incumbent Democratic Representative Wiley Nickel running for the hills. As business attorney and former prosecutor, Knott rode to victory on a wave of traditional Republican talking points. His priorities in office include crusading against abortion access, pledging unwavering support to Israel, and fighting the imaginary menace of, quote, woke ideologies in public schools. All right, we're zipping through these election reports. Raleigh's 7 city council races, most incumbents have hang on, while District A elects a former planning director. Along with its new mayor, Janet Cowell, the council will see a new leader in one of its district seats, while 6 incumbents will remain. District A, Mitchell Silver, Raleigh's former planning director, ousted the first-term incumbent, Mary Black, and defeated another challenger, Whitney Hill, taking about 40% of the vote. Black, 30, as an environmental justice advocate with a background in social media strategy, and he was elected in 22 as part of a cohort of four newcomers, all progressive millennial women. Black had broad appeal with young renters and working-class voters, but she came up short against Silver's well-financed campaign. Silver, New York's former Parks Commissioner for 7 years, New York City, that is, 64, helped develop Raleigh's 2030 Comprehensive Plan and Unified Development Ordinance during the decade he spent as Raleigh's top planner. Now in District B, Megan Patton, 34, former teacher and first-term incumbent, held on to her seat against challenger Jennifer McCollum, earning about 55% of the vote. In District C, the city council's most crowded race, incumbent Corey Branch fended off six challengers, holding onto his seat with about 40% of the vote, or twice as much as the next highest vote-getter, Tolulope Omokaye. In District D, Jane Harrison, 39, a coastal economics specialist who works for North Carolina C. Grant at the NC State University, ran unopposed for re-election, and she won more than 29,000 votes. And in District E, first-term incumbent council member Christina Jones, 39, looks to have narrowly defeated challenger John Cerquera, 45, a change management consultant who ran a campaign prioritizing smart growth and sustainable development, and Jones won about 3 points. And in the city council in Raleigh, the at-large races, the incumbents Stormy Fort and Jonathan Lambert Melton came in first and second place in the field of six. Forte, the top vote-getter for the second cycle in a row at this at-large race, won more than 98,000 votes citywide. Melton won more than 83,000. The third highest vote-getter was Republican candidate James Bledsoe. And the at-large candidates, Reeves Peeler, a Raleigh planning commissioner who ran a grassroots campaign, placed fourth, winning about 10% of the vote. Now, again in Wake County, the judiciary has become bluer, Democrats knocking out Republicans in Superior and District Court races. They picked up two seats on the Superior Court bench as well as one in the District Court. Superior District 10C, Seat 1, Attorney Sean Cole ousted Republican incumbent Justice Becky Holt, who has held that seat since 2017. And defeated unaffiliated candidate Stephanie Davis. Cole won with 48% of the vote, Holt 44%, and Davis took about 8. Cole, a personal injury lawyer, courtroom advocate, and legal studies teacher, says on his campaign website he believes, quote, every person who comes before a trial court must be heard and understood, end quote. Cole volunteers as a writer for the Wake County Bar Awards, which raises millions of dollars for legal aid, and has received several recognitions for volunteer and pro bono work in the legal profession. He's also an actor, a vocalist, and a multi-instrumentalist. That's 10C, Seat 1. For Superior Court, 10F, Seat 1, District Court Judge Jennifer Bedford ousted Graham Shirley, the incumbent since 2016, after he had been appointed to that seat by Governor Pat McCrory. Bedford took a little over 50% of the vote share, worked as a nonpartisan committee attorney at the General Assembly before Governor Cooper appointed her to her district court seat in 22. Superior Court judges preside over trials that decide cases involving felony charges, civil cases involving potential judgments over $25,000, and misdemeanor appeals from lower courts. In the District Court 10D Seat 3 race, criminal defense attorney Kevin Boxberger defeated Republican challenger Carl Roth, who practices in the areas of commercial litigation and family and criminal law. Boxberger, NC Central Law School graduate, military veteran and former Raleigh firefighter, was appointed to the open seat in district court in May, following former Chief District Court Judge Ned Mangum's retirement. Former Wake County Clerk of Court Blair Williams ran for that seat unopposed. Boxberger took 59% of the vote in the race against Roth. District court judges preside over civil, criminal, and juvenile cases, including child custody disputes. These judges are elected to four-year terms. Several more district court judges, all Democrats except one, Vartan Davidson-Tavidian III, ran unopposed. All right, a bit haphazard, but continuing our Indy Week in election results, the incumbent Lisa Grafstein has defeated Scott Lassiter for the North Carolina Senate District 13 seat. She's a civil rights attorney specializing in employment law, disability rights, and has served in this seat since 2023. She won just over 50% of that vote. She defeated her Republican challenger, Scott Lassiter, who took about 47%, and Libertarian Susan Hogarth. This district includes the southern part of Wake County and was labeled a toss-up that leads slightly Democratic by NC Common Cause. In 2022, Grafstein had won by a margin of nearly 30 percentage points, and that is District 13 for the North Carolina State Senate. All right, and I'll put pause for a second and look up the next one. District 37 for a House seat, Erin Paré holds on. The incumbent holds on to a House seat in District 37. She defeated the challenger Sophia Jackson to secure a third term in that state house, defeating that challenger with about 52% of the vote. Jackson said in a press statement, "Although we didn't secure the win, I remain motivated to keep pushing for progress." Paré was first elected in 2020. She chairs the Health Committee in the General Assembly and has supported the Republican agenda to expand private school vouchers, a program critics say is designed to systematically defund public education. Paré has also backed contentious bills limiting classroom discussion of race and LGBTQ issues. Her campaign's final week was marked by allegations of voter intimidation at polling sites. As reported by Indy, poll workers allege a years-long pattern of intimidation and harassment by both Paré and her husband, Wayne, targeting poll greeters, especially women. She had declined to comment on these claims when contacted. Her victory in southern Wake County, including Holly Springs and parts of Fuquay-Varina, reinforces Republican control in Wake County's more conservative-leaning southern district. Next from Indy, while all members of the Triangles State House and Senate delegation running for re-election to the seats they currently hold managed to keep them, Republicans look to have picked up two seats in Wake County, one in the State House, one in the State Senate. In Senate District 18, currently occupied by Democrat Mary Wills Bode, who declined to run for re-election, current State Representative Terrence Everett is trailing the GOP newcomer Ashley Adams by a razor-thin margin of 38 votes. If the results hold, the seat will be a pickup for Republicans. And the 18th district includes Wake Forest and portions of northern Wake County, drew civic significant campaign spending from both parties in what became one of the state's most closely watched Senate races. And in District 35, Everett's current district Democrat Yvonne Hopkins is trailing Republican Mike Scheitzel by about 2,000 votes, with Scheitzel taking a little over 50%. Libertarian Michael Oakes received 3.6%. Hopkins is a political newcomer, a family law attorney who owns a law practice in North Raleigh. Scheitzel, a military veteran, works as a litigation attorney representing small businesses, healthcare professionals, and faith-based organizations in civil disputes, according to his campaign website. He ran on an anti-abortion platform and cites the economy, education, and public safety as priorities. Most of the other ones you've already heard me report about in this particular article. This article is from the Elon News Network, not from IndyWeek, but it's important because the superintendent of public instruction for the state of North Carolina has been won by Mo Green. He won by about 51% of the vote. This job oversees day-to-day operations of the public instruction, serves as secretary and chief administrative officer of the Board of Education, and serves in the North Carolina Council of State. This race has gained national attention for one of North Carolina's most polarizing races on the ballot. Republican candidate Michelle Morrow turned heads by expressing support for abolishing the North Carolina Department of Education and cutting the state off from federal funds. Green himself has opposed public funding for private school vouchers, which breaks from the state General Assembly on education policy debate. Also in the Council of State, the Secretary of State in North Carolina, that race won by Elaine Marshall, the incumbent, and she ran against Republican challenger Chad Brown. Marshall was the first woman in North Carolina to be elected to a statewide executive branch, and she's held that role since 1996, 50.9% of the vote versus 49.1%, fairly close. Now, Indie Week listeners will have remembered some controversy involving this constitutional amendment to be included, and it was included on the North Carolina ballot this year. This was overwhelmingly backed by voters, by over 70% of voters supporting. This would reaffirm North Carolina's existing rules that bans non-citizens from voting. Again, you cannot, the Constitution says only citizens can vote, but this is one that narrowed the language a little bit. But the opponents said it risks spreading misinformation by tricking voters into thinking that non-citizens can vote in North Carolina. And there were several opportunities to for people to think that, to misinterpret the existing or the new one. However, it doesn't matter. This has now been passed by 78% of the voters. And so it will simply say that. The laws won't change. Just who's considered a legal voter, and that hasn't changed either. All right, and over in Carrboro now, Carrboro Town Council held a special election. The Cristobal Palmer, about 80% of the vote, with most precincts reporting, has chosen another progressive Democrat to fill Barbara Fouché's former town council seat, which she vacated after assuming the mayorship. Palmer will serve for only 1 year, but as an incumbent, would be in a prime position to pursue a full term if he chooses to run again in 2025. He defeated Isaac Woolsey, who campaigned, drew on his own experience as an autistic and disabled person, to emphasize the need for increased public transit hours and access across the Chapel Hill Carrboro area. Carrboro's progressive voters, though, says Indy, were likely put off by Woolsey's voter registration history. He said he was a registered Republican only to vote against Trump in primaries. And the Chronically Online, I love that, the Chronically Online may have noted his dust-up with grassroots media outlet Triangle Blog Blog. As just one more vote on an already ultra-progressive council, Palmer's greatest potential impact is likely to be through collaboration rather than radical adjustments to the council's current course. During his campaign, he promised to advocate for pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure improvements, to center equity in the town's climate agenda, and to take a hard look at the town's current zoning laws in order to better incentivize the creation of affordable housing. Then, let's see, I'm going to stay in the terms of elected people, municipals. All right. We got about Erin Paré. I've already told you about her. Linda Grafstein, I've reported about her election again. Where am I in my massive stack? All right, here's... We're talking about Orange County election results in general, and that includes the article I just read you about Carrboro. And let's see, county commissioners, incumbents Amy Fowler and Gene Hamilton, as well as newcomer Marilyn Carter, all Democrats, won their uncontested election for seats on the county commissioner board in Orange County. Democrat Phyllis Porte-Ascott, who had been appointed to fill a vacancy, was elected to her first term over H. Nathan Robinson with about 74% of the vote. Orange County Education Bond Referendum. I have an article about bonds, and I will read that. In fact, I'll go over to that right now. Across the triangle, voters say yes to bonds, except in Cary. Voters were asked to approve hundreds of millions of dollars in proposed bond measures ranging from K-12 education and public libraries to streets and sidewalks, parks, and affordable housing. Wake in Orange counties and in Durham, voters said yes to the bonds on their ballots, except for Cary voters who rejected bonds for affordable housing and parks projects. Here's how they broke down and a recap of what exactly this bond money will pay for. Durham Municipal, two bonds, one for parks, valued at $85 million, the other for streets and sidewalks, $115 million, passed with more than 70% of the vote, with more than 100,000 votes cast. At the end, at the highest end, a possible tax increase for homeowners to cover these would be about 3.5 cents for each $100 of assessed property value, which for the average home in Durham works out to about $9 extra a month, or a little over $100 a year. Now, the Parks Bond will pay for upgrades to Long Meadow and East End Parks, plus construction of a new water park beside the Wheels Roller Rink at Merrick Moore Park. The Streets and Sidewalks Bond would cover various road and sidewalk repairs, street paving projects, and sidewalk build-outs listed in the city's capital improvement projects. Dubbed the Connecting Durham Bonds, Durham City Council members were the initiative's biggest champions, but they weren't the only ones in favor. Residents representing different pockets of Durham, from futsal enthusiasts, that must be football enthusiasts, to environmentalists, organized in favor of the bonds and their $200 million price tag. The bonds came just in time, too. In October, Durham City Council adopted new design standards for transportation infrastructure. The new standards will modernize the city's building methods and prioritize features like sidewalks and bike lanes, increase equitable mobility overall, something residents have been clamoring for. Well, over then in Wake County, the library bond, voters approved $142 million public library bond that will see the construction of new libraries, renovations of others, and the expansion of the Fuquay Varina Community Library to become a new regional library. This bond will come at a minimal cost to taxpayers. It says just an additional $2.50 per $100,000 of property value, about $12 extra on the annual tax bill. Here's what the bond will pay for: a new community library in Rollsville and one in the Friendship area of Apex. The Athens Drive Community Library, which is now in the high school, will be replaced, and a replacement of the library in Wendell community. And a new facility to be determined will promote digital equity. There's no details on that. Renovations to 8 existing library locations: the Express Library on Fayetteville Street downtown, Green Road Community Library out near Capitol Boulevard, Leesville Community, Northeast Regional Library, the Richard Harrison Community Library. That's on New Bern Avenue on the way east out of the city and along an important new transport update corridor. Southeast Regional Library, Zebulon Community, and the Library Administration Building. All of those facilities and renovations to come from this bond. Over in Kerry, definitely the most expensive set of referenda, the town of Kerry asked residents to approve a combined $590 million to pay for affordable housing initiatives worth $30 million and six parks project worth a combined $560 million. Voters said no. Affordable housing bond failed by a three-point margin, or about 48,000 against 45,000 in favor. So the no votes succeeded there. The parks bond failed by a wider margin, 51,500 against 42,000 in favor. If voters had approved the bonds, the town's tax receipts would have increased by 9 cents. 8.5 cents for parks and a 0.5 cent for housing, staggered in 3 cent incremental increases, 26, 28, and 2030. Then the Orange County Schools, Chapel Hill Carborough bonds, that $300 million education bond referendum, approved by about 68% of voters, will provide about $175 million to Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools, and about $125 million to Orange County schools, used only for school facility improvements. The current spending plan calls for the replacement of five elementary schools and a middle school, replacing Carborough, Estes Hills, Frank Porter Graham Elementaries in the Chapel Hill Carborough system, and replacing Orange County Elementary and Middle in Orange County schools. Based on current projections, the bond is projected to cost a property taxpayer $34 for every $100,000 of assessed property value. But it will only cover a portion of the estimated $1 billion in improvements needed over the next 15 years to bring the district facilities up to modern standards. And despite the high approval rate, not everyone has full faith in the elected board officials. In the Chapel Hill Carborough system, community members have separately questioned the implementation of the recent staff downsizing plan because as enrollment as the district has declined. It'll be difficult to truly take the temperature of the populace until several board members are up for election in next year. And across five separate referenda, Chapel Hill voters overwhelmingly approved $44 million for a slew of connectivity and equity-focused projects, and they include $15 million for affordable housing to build new and preserve existing and acquire property to build on, leverage state and federal funding, and create regional partnerships. $15 million for public facilities that would replace fire stations 3 and 4 with new ones. $7.5 million for streets and sidewalks to improve, expand connectivity and ADA accessibility on Fordham Boulevard and Ephesus Church Road, and support sidewalk projects in schools near, in areas near schools and transit. $4.5 million for parks and rec, to replace the artificial turf on Homestead Park playing fields, replace the community center climbing wall, build a splash bed, enhance pickleball courts, and more. And $2 million for open space and greenways, and that would help to build the Bolin Creek Greenway extension. The town's debt fund allocates money to pay debts and build future debt capacity, so the funds will be distributed with no tax increase for residents. All right, I believe I've exhausted my supply of political and similar articles, and I can now move to culture and maybe some food. And this article I've put off since the 26th of September. It's been in my folder for reading when I have a chance, and now I do. An Evening with Ann Byrne, B-Y-R-N, took place on October the 14th at 6 p.m. She's a cookbook author who gained national prominence in the early 2000s for teaching people how to gussy up boxes of Betty Crocker with add-ins like sour cream and sherry. She still embraces her cake mix doctor moniker, but Byrne's most recent cookbooks have seen her take less of an advisory role and more of a narrative archival one. Out this month, her latest book, Baking in the American South, 200 Recipes and Their Untold Stories, only includes three of her own family's recipes. The rest are sourced from department stores, school cafeterias, mills, and churches across the South, drawn from people like Country Ham King Alan Benton and 1930s-era boarding house owner Ma Hoyle. A Nashville native and fifth-generation Tennessean who spent years as a food editor at Atlanta Journal and the Tennessean, Byrne brings a sense of both familiarity and curiosity to the rigorously researched, effortlessly written Baking in the American South, which features recipes from her home state plus 13 others. She writes, "If you bake a vast, deep-dish fruit pie in most places in the South, you've made a cobbler. But in Surrey and Wilkes counties in North Carolina, that same dish is called a sonker, S-O-N-K-E-R. Sonker was the invention of Scots and Scots-Irish immigrants who began settling in the Yadkin Valley of North Carolina in the early 1700s. The word traces to the Gaelic songle or songle, meaning little mess. Ahead of this debut event at the Durham Hotel, the Indy chatted in a Q&A format. This article has been written about the research that went into baking in the American South. And these are the questions and answers. While you were working on this book, how much were you on the road versus doing research and calling on sources from throughout your career? And she answers, it was about 50-50. It started as a project that might have been more on the road, but I think because of COVID, the research came first. It was a matter of educating myself about or trying to figure out what was the southern region. If I wanted to include these states, how did I learn about them? Who did I contact in that state? And then who did I talk to for really broad cultural topics? I wanted to learn about railroads and slavery and rice cultivation, and all those topics had come up. It really feels like a work of journalism as well as a functional cookbook. It was like walking on railroad ties, straddling back and forth between the two. Why did you decide to take this reported approach? It's just the way I've always been. I've always been curious. I'm always asked a lot of questions. I'm a newspaper journalist. I came to cookbooks via newspapers, so I've never left that interest in digging out answers and finding people that no one's ever heard of, because that would be the type of stories I would want to report on if there were still newspapers like there used to be. I'm not a historian, but I am a curious person, and I've always loved the South, and I've always loved to bake, and I've brought that real keen interest, and I have the time to dedicate to find people. I found out about a fabulous resource right here in Nashville. Vanderbilt Medical School has one of the largest cookbook collections in the country. There's just so many resources. With Ancestry.com and Newspapers.com, anybody could dig into the story if they wanted to. If you didn't believe the first 25 pop-ups from your Google search, set those aside and then go really look. Something that stood out to me in the introduction was you saying the recipes in the South, quote, became hyper-regional because their people were. But also that recipes transcended state lines. You wrote, A small town in southern Kentucky was a hub, connecting rail lines north and south, allowing imported bananas to travel from docks in New Orleans and Mobile clear up to New York and Philadelphia, which might explain why there are so many banana pudding recipes embedded in Kentucky books. Do you have thoughts of whether we can still be hyper-regional in that way, if there are still siloed communities that are coming up with hyper-regional recipes? That's a real powerhouse of a question. There are some quirky recipes like the Lane cake and the sticky lemon cheesecake that are real deep, deep south. I never heard of those when I grew up in Tennessee. Those recipes stuck in certain communities in part because they were a lot of trouble. They were written about in local cookbooks, but probably because of their expense and the time it took to make them, they just didn't go everywhere. There are also the types of recipes I have some fear about dying out. The Lane cake. And the smell of the whiskey on the counter that goes into the cake is mentioned in To Kill a Mockingbird, but is only sort of just referred to. The Lane cake happens to also be Jimmy Carter's favorite cake. He's about to turn 100, so anyone in their 30s may not know, may not really care, that that was Jimmy Carter's favorite cake. Whereas something like the banana pudding you mentioned crosses racial lines, economic lines, and state lines because it's affordable. And because people who lived near the docks in coastal cities like Mobile and New Orleans had access to bananas that fell off the bunches that didn't get loaded onto the train. I think a lot of it has to do with access and availability and being able to cross lines. I know that's a mishmash of an answer. It was a mismatch of a question. It's a good one to ponder, for sure. I'm going to keep thinking about it this weekend when I'm at a book festival in Arkansas. Of all the states that had quirky recipes, it's Arkansas. Their eyes fell on this pie from Kentucky. It's a brown sugar meringue pie, and actually it's a great one because it's a farm recipe. It's a fast recipe. You don't have to caramelize sugar. Anybody can make it. They've got these weird recipes, possum pie, cherry nut pie, Circe chocolate roll, that you just don't see anywhere else in the South, and I wonder why. I'm thinking about how you said you found a lot of these recipes in print archives. I feel like probably even these super niche, quirky recipes are online somewhere, but there's definitely something to having a curator, someone to dust them off and put them all in one place and platform them. And she answers, and test them. A lot of those quirky ones, they weren't really interesting. The cantaloupe cream pie is a real outlier. We tested that a dozen times to get it right because the flavor was fantastic. It tastes like ripe cantaloupe. I've never seen anything like it. And it spoke of the railroads. It spoke of the ingenious nature of this cook to be able to take this mystery basket of ripe cantaloupe and say, what the heck am I going to do with this? And then he makes his pie on a railroad car. So it's like, we're going to get this recipe right. It took a while because you need the juice of the melon to make a custard of the pie. If you have a really ripe melon, you could just squeeze the heck out of the juice or throw it all in the food processor and then strain it. But if you don't, we figured out a way to actually microwave the slices of cantaloupe to soften them and to kind of change the cell structure, a little bit. Then you throw it in the food processor and strain the puree. Could you talk a little bit about the recipes in your book with origins in North Carolina? North Carolina is such an interesting state. You have probably birthed more interesting recipes than Tennessee has, but we do have something in common. We're kind of long and narrow. You have mountains. You've got your Midlands or whatever. You've got your coast. And I think that's very similar to Tennessee, where we have the mountains in the east, farmlands in the middle, and then the delta in Memphis. One of the revelations that came out of the mountains of North Carolina is cathead biscuits. I really looked for the story on cat heads because the name is often kind of tossed around just to mean a big biscuit the size of a cat head. Is the research I did into the all logging camps of North Georgia and Western North Carolina that I could really place cat head biscuits from that area. Then there are recipes that trace back to the influx of people that came into the middle part of your state, Moravians, Germans, Scots, like the sonker, the shortening bread, the Moravian sugar cake. And then there are a couple in here that were inspired by Bill Neal, who was a chef in Chapel Hill. The persimmon pudding, the lemon meringue pie. These are classic Bill Neal because they're old and yet they feel very new and modern. From the coastline, I think of Bill Smith with the Atlantic beach pie. Another great North Carolina recipe is Ma Hoyle's double crust blackberry cobbler that came out of Gastonia. It's a boarding house recipe, a type of recipe that would have been common throughout the South, a big pan of cobbler, but what makes it unique is the way she makes it with double crust. Her story was that she started a boarding house because she had to support her children and started renting out rooms in her house and cooking. Boarding houses sprung up around railroad lines and railroad stops, and that's where people would stay before there were hotels. The South was largely rural, it was isolated, and it was poor. This story, I think, feeds into that. Also, blackberries grew wild throughout North Carolina. Recipes like the cobbler that have blackberries tell you that people were foraging for what they had. They were using wild foods in creative ways, and women who could bake could elevate that. They could elevate the ordinary ingredient. The book really emphasizes all the contributions that black women have made to Southern baking. How did you start navigating sharing recipes and stories that are not from your own culture? I tried the best I could. When I finished the manuscript, I said, people are just going to love it, or they're going to find a million things wrong with it. I put a lot out there. It was very humbling to be able to tell these stories. When it felt like it was just getting too difficult, when I felt like, should I be talking about this? I just reverted back to the recipes and I let them do the talking. I really wanted to set right out in the very beginning, this is not a book about me. I knew I didn't want it to be Ann Burns Southern Baking. I wanted it to be about the South. And let's go to a music article. This was actually written October 31st. It pertains to a vinyl release show, which was held November 2nd. But again, it will be at November 2nd at 8 p.m. in Carrboro. And let's see. So, and it is from Schooner. And it's the You Forgot About Your Heart 20th Anniversary Vinyl Show. And so this is basically about the record. Of course, the show's release show has already taken place. In the extensive liner notes that come with the new 20th Anniversary reissue of You Forget About Your Heart, that was the debut album by the steadfast local indie rock band Schooner, Grayson Curran, whose former The Indies music editor, sweeps us back to a heady moment in 2004 when a new wave of triangle bands were making a noise, approaching that of their 90s forebears. Of that new vanguard, Des Arc, De Yarmond Edison, Ticonderoga, the Kingsbury Manx, and leading the pack, the Rosebuds, Schooner might have been the most beguiling, he writes, Grayson Curran does, calling their debut on the Durham label Pox World Empire a gem of sad-eyed southern songwriting wonder, even if most people have yet to hear it. Here's a chance to rectify that. It's first time on vinyl, courtesy of 10,000 Hertz Records, remastered by the redoubtable wax smith Wesley Wolfe and enhanced with demos. with the original lineup getting back together to play the thing in that Cat's Cradle back room on September, November 2nd. Schooner began as Reed Johnson's side project to his Brit poppy rock band, the AM, before becoming a 20-year institution. It's since sprouted its own side project, Sun Studies. Though steadily steered by Johnson, the lineup has grown fluid since this original band, Trip Cox, Billy Elfin, and Reed's sister, Catherine Johnson, stamped out its indelible first two records, Bleeding Youthful Charisma and Conviction. Well, we recently reached Reed by video chat at his house in Durham to reminisce about the old days and see how they feel now, 2 decades and what seems like several lifetimes later. And this article, again, is a Q&A format. Russell Baggett of 10,000 Hertz liked You Forget About Your Heart enough to turn his record store into a record label. Would you say it's the fan favorite? That was definitely one that people gravitated to, and it was the first one. It's the shortest. A pretty simple record in a lot of ways, but I still get people reaching out and saying it's their favorite. It had a kind of youthful enthusiasm and the emotions of being in your 20s, even though the songs were in a lot of ways about heartbreak or being pissed off at the scene. What were you pissed off about? I've always had a little animosity towards any kind of scene that feels cliquey. Back then, I had a lot of friends in Raleigh, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. Durham was always the easiest place to be to me, but what can you do for me was the kind of vibe that you ended up getting. It's like kids today have to do social media to get eyeballs on stuff, and we had to bullshit with people. Sometimes it felt like freaking high school, like a coolness contest, and whoever did the most cocaine were the biggest band. I've always had that little chip on my shoulder, but it's a lot chiller now, and I feel there's a little more intermingling with different folks. You get to the sense from the record the band started from the joy of friends playing together. I had a rock band, the AM, and started Schooner as my outlet for these more like sensitive songs. Some of them were about breaking up with the first person I actually fell in love with, and I couldn't do anything about it. So these tracks started pouring out on the floor of my bedroom, a total basement four-track story. It was me emoting. But Tripp played in the AM with me and was always big a cheerleader. And one show when the AM couldn't play, I just got a band together to do these Schooner songs. When Zeno Gill wanted to record us, my sister had been playing for a little bit with us, and Tripp had been a guitar, but I wanted him at bass. And Billy, who we were friends with because we were close with the Rosebud, the simplicity of his drumming, just the facts, ma'am. It just kind of came together magically, and that was the band through our second album, Hold On Too Tight. The last show we played was the album release 17 years ago. We played together a month ago for the first time. I think all of us felt it was surreal and fun to be back together. The whole practice, Billy was smiling the whole time. When I get all the emotions, I get a little dizzy sometimes. It was overwhelming, but in a good way. Zeno and Pox World were a whole thing in the aughties, remind us? Pox World Empire, run by Zeno Gill, who was in a band called The Sames. He had a bunch of cool, mostly Durham bands on that label. Jet Rink, Razzle and Pleasant, Torch Marauder was on it. He was putting out a thing called Compulation, and he did three of them that featured 25 bands from North Carolina, and we were on the first one of those. Ivan Howard had sent him our four-track stuff, and he wanted to record us. That spot he lived on James Street in Durham was a little magic studio with all the toys and things to play with. Zeno and I always worked together really well. It was fun and light, which is good because some of the songs were dark. Mark Lebetkin, also part of Pox World, really helped promote the record to press and radio, and from tiny mix tapes to freaking GQ. What did it take to get the original lineup back together? It came easy. I asked my sister first, then Tripp and Billy were like, yeah, for sure. Tripp's in Wilmington now, but we can practice on the weekends. Getting Nathan Oliver White to play extra guitar, too. He used to play with us back then. So we have a dentist that's playing in the band. Always healthy. Gum health is important. Do you think you're going to keep doing it with the original lineup? I wouldn't doubt if we played more shows together. I do have a schooner record that was pretty much done, and then the computer we were mixing on crashed. I've been dragging my feet since COVID, basically. We'll probably put it out next year. I'm working on a Sun Studies record as well. You're going to need a Sun Studies side project soon. I thought about doing some kind of experimental thing, something just instrumental. What if eventually you work your way back around and wind up starting the AM again? Right, for sure. That seems like it would make complete sense. Do these songs mean different things to you now that they did then? Or did you see what they meant all along in a different way? Yes. I was singing some of these songs last weekend, and they were emotional for a whole other set of circumstances. It's especially interesting when you pull that out of a new experience. Therapy helps. I can remember what exactly that emotion is about, and that's the nostalgic piece. It's nice, it's a friend, even when it's a heartbreak situation. But the emotions can be pulled from new experiences with the same song. Well, unbelievably, I've finished a complete article to close my broadcast today from Indie Week. I'm John Federson, and if I rush through the opening announcements, I'll say them again. The North Carolina Reading Service provides this program after its initial broadcast on Fridays and has podcast section, and you can hear it all again if you love any part of it for any reason. Again, IndieWeek.com is a website that contains all these stories and lots of back articles that I've already read in the past, but it's a vast library as well, and you can go there to find any of this information. It's provided this broadcast by your North Carolina Reading Service for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, and so I've got nothing else to say, and I'll let our Giant Symphony Orchestra play us out from the NCRS, John Federson for Indie Week. So long.